I know. That's exactly how I feel about every raclette night. I hate raclette. I don't get the trend. Everyone invites us to do raclette, and I always want to say no.
I personally am one of those guys, you know. If I weren't in the industry myself, I probably wouldn't watch German comedies, to be honest. I think Tom Schilling, the main character of Goldfish, warned me about this and said, look, this was a great experience and everything, and we'll, you know, everyone loves you now, but, you know, just to let you know, your second film's not going to be like that.
Okay. Guys, welcome back to another episode of Artsy Fartsy Immigrants. We have a very special, special guest today. Someone I've looked forward to having back on the program for a very long time. I think it's been over a year since the first time we spoke. But ladies and gentlemen, Alireza Golavshan.
Hi. I think it's more than a year, but I lost my sense of time during the pandemic. So I think a lot of people did. So I don't know. Maybe it's 3 years. It was 3 or 4 years ago. I don't know. I think it was before the pandemic.
It's crazy. Actually.
It was. It must. I think it's over 2 years.
Yeah. I remember 2019.
Us taking pictures and all being very close to each other. Yeah, so it must have been before the pandemic.
Yeah. Right. Those strange before times. No, but we were just talking like a little bit before we started about how doing things like this, meetings or interviews or podcasts and stuff, it's just become so convenient to do over Zoom because, you know, technically we could have found, you know, maybe it would have been more difficult, but we could have found a pocket of time to all meet at the studio and do it in person. But because of everyone's different schedules and because of how we've adjusted to home life through the pandemic, it's just easier sometimes to do it like this.
It's especially easier if people already know each other. I think it's a little bit difficult, more difficult if it would be the first time. You know, if when the pandemic started, everyone was like, okay, this is gonna change everything. No one's gonna go back to the office, you know, like never again. And now people, you know, and I think they underestimated the base that they had, you know, from the years working together in an office. And then now that new people are starting off in the office, they kind of feel they don't have that feeling with, you know, the digital connection and everything. So I think there's people are going back to. Yeah, but let's see how it develops. But for us, it's quite convenient, I think, so because we know we have met, and
we've been through it before. Yeah, there was a couple of different experiences I had to do over Zoom during the pandemic that didn't really fit, like didn't really work for me. I told Mo about one of them last week, but one of them was a concert that I was asked to perform via Zoom pretty early on in the pandemic, maybe like, you know, June, early summer of 2020 or something. And I really, really, I wouldn't say like I regretted that, but I just would never have done that again. It was, you know, there's no interaction with the audience. You have this weird speaker view where you don't even see anybody really. And then the audio doesn't, like, I performed with this other artist who tried to get her vocal effects and her guitar effects to go to be, you know, to be the output that the audience hears on their computers, but we couldn't figure it out. So she was playing there with her reverb and whatever her delays, and the audience was still just hearing like a pure guitar and a flat vocal through this, and it just didn't work. And anyway, a lot of things over Zoom these days, but some things work, some things don't.
That's true.
But let's talk about you. Let's talk about you because that's what the people are here for. So we had the pleasure back in 2019 to talk about your breakout. That was your debut feature, correct?
The Goldfish. The Goldfish? True. It was the first feature length film of the day.
Right. Yeah. And it, you know, was released to, you know, wide successful acclaim and did very well. And everyone loved it. I personally loved it. And it was really fun to talk about it. Now you have a new movie out now called JGA or Yotge A. And let's talk about that one a little bit.
Yeah.
Where did you, Do you want to talk a little bit about, in layman's terms, what it's about for people who haven't seen it yet?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's for people who have seen it, it started, it had a theatrical release in March, and it's not playing in theaters anymore, I think. I think it's so you have to wait till it's on some platform or release on DVD or Blu-ray, if anyone has a Blu-ray player. These days, I don't know, but so that's just the, you know, technical information. But it's about JGA is a German, how do you say, Abkürzung?
Like the initials?
The initials for Junggesellenabschied, which is a hen party, in as the British say, what you do before the wedding. How do you say in America? You don't say hen party.
I didn't get that.
Right? I think the Americans have a different word for hen.
I know some Brits, they say like stag do and hen do.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
But the Germans, they don't say like Junggesellenabschied, right? They don't do the...
Yeah, this...
Innen.
Not really. Most people just say Junggesellenabschied because, I don't know, they just swallow a syllable, I don't know. But actually, and there is this shorter form, which is JGA, and which in this case also stands for the first initials of the three main characters, Yasmin, Gina, and Anna, three single ladies in their mid-30s who are kind of left out, and because everyone else in their of the friends are getting married or are having babies and everything, and you know, the friendships are, you know, feel kind of different. And the movie starts with how Yasmin, our main character, organized this hen party for a good friend of hers. And they surprise her at the door, and they're just these three girls because everyone else couldn't make it because of, you know, the baby wouldn't sleep without her mom and so on. And now this hen party even doesn't really take off because Helena, the bride-to-be, confesses that she's pregnant and she can't drink. So, and she wants to be picked up by her husband, and then our three main characters are left with, like, nothing, just the plans to go to Ibiza actually with the bride-to-be, but now they decide to go anyway because fuck those,
fuck the haters.
Fuck the haters, yeah. Like they say, okay, you know, let's do what we can do. Actually, and there's this ambivalence because they actually kind of wish they would also have families and maybe, you know, a good partner or maybe even kids or so on, but they don't have it. And they say, like, you know, we don't need it anyway. And they go to Ibiza and continue the hen party anyway, even without the bride. And then the actual story starts because Yasmin is single for a long time, for 8 years, because she still
she's kind of hung up on her ex.
Yeah, right? She's hung up on her ex, Tim. And she, in Ibiza, she meets Tim, who is also there for his stag night.
His bachelor party.
A bachelor party, yeah. Yes. So where, and she pretends to be the bride-to-be because she doesn't want to confess that she's still single and hung up on him. And from that lie, you know, the story develops and it becomes more weird and everything. So it's the humor is a little bit different. I think it's for people who like cringe humor or and things like that, because many things go wrong, and they have the, I think we have one of the most embarrassing striptease scenes that you can make in the film. So it's from the great tone, it's a little different than the Goldfish, and but it's still a comedy, but a little bit different than you would expect, because a lot of people told me it's about this it's like a hangover kind of thing, and it's not. It's really more closer to Bridesmaids or even, you know, some Judd Apatow movies. More characters are in the foreground, and they're like personal or subjective drama. So there's no tiger in the hotel room or anything like that.
No, you can really really see the influence or the inspiration from a film like Bridesmaids in this. Definitely. And I personally just wanted to thank you for once again giving us the opportunity to watch it with English subtitles. That's really, 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 really helpful and cool. And
I hope they were okay.
To, the studios.
Yeah. Because
totally. Yeah. Yeah. There was really. It's what's so hard about with comedy, especially in German, is some things just don't technically translate the same. That, you know what I mean? Like some just very small like words or phrases just are meant to be said in German.
Yeah.
So there was only a couple of small things. Obviously, I had watched it with Ify and she, because she wanted to see it too. And she, yeah. There's only a couple of things where I was like, that's funny. They said this, but the translation would be like, I don't know, someone like, there was one time they said a word, but the translation was Steven Mnuchin. Mm-hmm. And I went, that's strange. They didn't say Steven Mnuchin, but they said a word. And she's like, oh yeah, but they mean this. She's like, don't worry about it. That's what that means. And I was like, oh, okay. No, but it's really, really, it was really great. And there was no hiccups at all. And the humor translated, most importantly, the humor still translated really well. And it's very funny. I feel stupid because I didn't know that Jotke asked it for Junggesellenabschied, but of course it does.
But I have one more question regarding the subtitles, because I think this is an interesting thing and I don't know so much about it. Like with German films, like German comedy movies, like you just put two out recently, with making it ready for an international audience, is it something that is planned? Like, okay, we're going to take care of English subtitles and maybe an English dubbing, or we do nothing at all and see how it like performs in Germany and then see if we'll do anything of that.
Well, it's different each time. I don't even remember why we have English subtitles. I think we try to submit it to festival at some point or something. Maybe that's the reason. And usually, the production company doesn't invest too much time or money into the English subtitles if there is no outpost, like there's going to be an English release or international release. That's why I'm asking if the subtitles were okay, because I think they were just made like in 2 days or something. So just to get the main idea across. So I think if we would have international release, I think we would look into it furthermore and try to fix it. Do the jokes and everything and see if everything's working fine.
Sure.
But it's different each time. So I think there is actually no need for a German film to have English subtitles. And I'm always curious why they don't, even if there is, like with the Goldfish, we had English subtitles with that film, but they didn't include it on the DVD and the Blu-ray. I don't know if there are like legal issues or anything like that or why they do it. But
that's strange.
Because a lot of people ask me if they can have a DVD, and but they don't speak German, and say sorry that the English subtitles aren't included, but we have them, so I don't know.
Right. So that was strange too. I mean, I remember talking about that when we first talked about a possible screening of the Goldfish, and you said actually that they had the English subtitles because it was playing on a flight. Was it on a Delta flight or something? Right.
Yeah, yeah. I think Jotke is at the moment Lufthansa also playing at Lufthansa or something like that. I saw Instagram posts. Yeah, but then maybe that's the reason why they do English subtitles. Yeah.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And what's interesting to me, because I've, as the non-native German speaker in the group, I've always, from the day one of moving here, had a sort of an issue with the lack of possibilities for subtitles with German content, because, I mean, you have great German content that doesn't necessarily need it. Like it blends both languages, like Unorthodox or Everyone Loves Dark or there's a few others, like Breaking Even, like shows like this that kind of, that doesn't share their languages. But anyway, shows that do, and you don't really need it. Sometimes it works just fine. But I've always been very interested in film and television. And that's the departments I've always studied and worked in. And there's so much content from people in Munich, especially that I've met personally, like yourself, or people that I've wanted to see. Oh, that's that producer that you met at that the screening. Oh, that's with this. Oh, this is his movie. Let's see if we can watch his movie to get an idea of people and what they do and their creativity. And And 99% of the time, if not almost 100% of the time, unless it's a very, very internationally well-known successful movie, it just doesn't have the option for subtitles in any other language. Because I want to see it in original German. I don't want dubs or anything. But to see the subtitles, like, and I know so many people too. I have a lot of, obviously, international friends that I know here. And a lot of them have the same issue. They say, we would watch so much more like German films or German series, like to try this and try that.
Yeah.
But there's no chance for English subtitles. Like even this show Wrong that we just put out, which I had the pleasure of doing the music on, I know what they're doing because I've seen the episodes so many times. And of course, Ify wrote a couple of them. I know what's happening and I really get most of what's going on. But I really can't share it with too many international friends because they would it would really help them to get the jokes if there's like a little help at the bottom. But I never understood why that wasn't like when it goes, let's say it goes to like Netflix or Apple.
Well,
and if a film goes to Netflix or Apple, it feels like, you know, you'd have the, they'd be like, okay, well, we need some subtitles for different things here.
Yeah, because, I mean, it has some legal issues here because Netflix is always, when it's their own production, original production, they have it available on every country that they're streaming to. So you have a German Netflix show like Dark and they're going to release it in, I don't know, 160 countries. So they're very... you know, of course, they want to have subtitles in many languages, as many languages as possible, or even dubbed versions. And that was a show that was dubbed for English audiences, American audiences. And like when it's released to a platform that's just, you know, it's shown in Germany and even Amazon, like Amazon don't do it. So they have German productions for an Amazon Prime that are only released in Germany. So they don't. They don't include English subtitles for that. And they don't see the necessity for German. That's the way they think, I guess. So it's always bothered me because when I go to France, they have, it's this cineast country, of course. And they have, when you go shopping for DVD collections and Blu-ray collections, they have amazing boxes and collections. So, you know, like things that you've never seen, you know, like they have the complete filmography of someone in a beautifully designed box. And the French usually don't have English subtitles either. So either it's, you know, like American movies, like if it's a Hitchcock box or anything, you can buy it. But if it's a Eric Romer or whatever box, I hold it in my hands and I see just, okay, it's a beautiful collection of every Eric Romer movie that he has ever made, but no English subtitles. And
but that's for other reasons, I guess, in France than in Germany.
Sorry? Yeah, maybe.
I guess
maybe
that's for other reasons in France.
I think in France it's even worse than here, you know, because actually German people are interested in, you know, having their work shown to, you know, or, you know, included. Whatever, but yeah, I hope it's going to change because English is becoming more and more important in German society too, and I think sooner or later.
Yeah. Man, absolutely. I personally hope it changes for obvious reasons, but like even when you just hear how German is shifting, like post-millennial generation into Gen Z, you kind of hear these people from 30s down to teens using so much more English in their German than you would ever imagine that they would. Like I hear it all the time. Just passing down the street, they'll start a sentence in German. Maybe it's talking about a date that went bad. And then they'll use, like they'll exaggerate how they feel using an English idiom. They'll say something, the date went so well. And I thought to myself, oh my God, what an asshole. And then they go back to, you know, or whatever. But that's,
yeah, or even the word, I mean, I think cringe really was like the word of the year or so, like last year, I think. I mean, you know, because right. There's this concept. Because, you know, of course, yeah, American films and shows are, you know, everywhere, and you know, we get, and language has always been, you know, cultural thing, and I think this, you know, it's more about the concept of something than the word, because I always think, well, we could have a German word for cringe or whatever, you know, but it's not about the word, it's about the concept, and the concept was shown in, you know, in American movies or TV shows first, so that's why That's why German has no chance to compete with those concepts coming from the media and stories that we see.
But getting back to France here, a little fun fact: did you know about the Ministry for Neologisms in France?
Mm-hmm.
They get like a ministry or an official state-run institute that has to find new words when like new English terms come in, because they just don't want to take the English word. So I don't know. The computer came out and they found the word l'ordinateur.
Yeah, that's true.
Just because they don't want to use an English word there.
Well, that's funny because when I was still in Iran, I think 1997 or something, the Iranian government started the same thing. They initialized the ministry or something. I don't know, just an office to come up with like fax or computer. And it was the time where, especially because of the technology that was, you know, coming and imported into the country, and everything had the new, you know, English name. They started coming up with silly new names, and at that time everyone laughed at it. But you know, now I have a different feeling about it, because it it has become so, you know, there's just too much. It's not just the computer and the fax machine or something that has this English name. It's like if you just let it, you know. I kind of understand that now. I think it's not just because of patriotism, but, you know, just to keep some sort of language alive, and even though it's through artificial, tools here, like you know, coming up with new words, which is silly. You know, it's just a silly job, I think, just to sit down and think, okay. But I don't know how the German word Rechner, which is computer, came about, so... I always wondered if
Rechner.
Yeah, we say Rechner. We don't say computer. We say calculator.
Funny, basically. I think I never. Even in the German language books that I studied since I moved here, they say der Computer.
Yeah, it's also a thing. Yeah.
So actually,
you can say computer, der Computer, but Rechner is, I think, I don't know. I think Rechner is more common, isn't it? I don't know.
Yeah, I feel so as well, but. I think when it comes to this, Germany's pretty easy. Just describe things by what they do. Flugzeug, thing that flies.
Right.
Calculator.
Yeah, the Zeug thing is
machine
crazy
that calculates.
That's. Wait, say the last thing you said again.
Calculator, like thing that calculates.
Right. Right. Now that is actually really funny how it does. Sorry, I'm just upgrading this. Zoom while we talk quickly, because I forgot that I didn't do that, and it was like, this meeting will end in 10 minutes. And I was like, no, please don't do that. But I this thing about France creating a word just to not use the English word, I think is so, it's almost rude. But I totally get it. But no, most importantly is Yodkia. So JGA, you know, I really enjoyed the movie, and it was really funny. And like you said earlier when you were describing it, it is a different style and a different type of humor from The Goldfish. And yeah, I had some questions about it because it was so interesting. This meeting now has unlimited minutes.
Yeah
baby. Okay. So now that that's out of the way, how, talking about, because you wrote and directed both, there's a lot of work and love and time that goes into not only writing a film, but directing a film. And with The Goldfish, I want to talk a little bit about the writing process alone first, The Goldfish versus JGA. Which one took longer to get just right? And how was it comparably in terms of the struggle to get a finished script done?
Well, I think the challenges were different, but I think The Goldfish took a bit longer, or actually quite a bit longer. I think The Goldfish started as just an assignment for me to write a screenplay, because I was just out, not even out. I was still studying, I think, at the university here in Munich. And they said, and the producer, Justina Müsch, saw my latest film, which was a 40 minutes like a film school, a short film, and she said, "Well, I like the tone and how you handled the subject of, you know, disability." And she had an idea for, you know, big budget mainstream comedy with a, you know, about disability. And she said, "Just give it a try. You know, paper is cheap, so it's easy to start as a writer in the business." So they say, "Okay, just 10 pages. You start usually as with an expose and it's paid okay, you know. And if it's not going anywhere, you just say goodbye and say, okay, that didn't work out." But she really liked the expose. And the next step is usually what we call a treatment. It's a bit longer, like 20 to sometimes even 40, 50 pages, where there it's mm-hmm. not a script yet, so there's no dialogue, but you know, you get the whole, you know, story fleshed out.
It's all
out.
The beats,
yeah,
right?
Every beat is in it, so you get, you know, you basically the next step, you can easily start writing a screenplay. And I think we quite, you know, with the goal which we're looking for, you know, because it's a different story in terms of, because there is a lot of plot in it, because there is on the one hand, you have this story of this investment banker having his own private crisis that, you know, after accident, not being too able to walk again. And on the other hand, you have this comedy story about he trying to save his money from a Swiss bank account and everything. So when it comes to plot, so you have a lot of more possibilities. It could go that way, you know, what can go wrong here, or thinking about different comedy pieces and what could be the ending be, and so on. And so we were, you know, trying different routes, I think, with the Goldfish, and we had the time. So, and especially if, because it was not a, you know, a film by so and so. So, you know, there was no like a brand on it that, you know, everyone was not like, okay, say, let's go. So the only thing that, you know, gave the whole project was a script, you know, so they had to send it to the cast, and right. Everything had to be convinced just by the script, because no one knew me or whatever, and it was not like a franchise movie or anything, so it was just the script. So we took our time back then for the Goldfish to get the script right, and I think it was 1.5 years or so we worked on the script. And after finishing,
that makes sense. Yeah,
after finishing the Goldfish, I wrote a treatment for JGA. And after that,
so you already had the idea brewing.
The idea for JGA is older than the Goldfish. Actually, a friend of mine Isabel Haug, who also produced this film, she had this idea to make a German comedy about this, with that setting of Junggesellenabschied, you know, with a hen party. And she had already a different story, and she gave it to me and said, "Have a look and give me some feedback." And I read the story and I said, "Well, I really like the setting and your main character. I don't know what that was exactly." And said, "But I have a different vision. Would it be okay for you to try to, you know, to make a story together for something?" And then we tried. It was still a different story than it is now. And I think it was a bit too high concept or too conceptual, and we didn't get anywhere. It was a little bit, we tried really hard to be mainstream, and I think that was the problem mm-hmm. with the story back then, that it didn't have really soul or anything. So we just put it back in the shelves.
Right.
And I don't know when that was, you know, a year after or so, it was like, you know, 11 p.m. just, you know, I was sitting watching TV or something, and then suddenly an image came to my mind, and I saw these three girls sitting at the Döner Kebab Imbiss, and, you know, having the tragedy, you know, after losing this party, and, you know, all hope, and, you know, with tzatziki around the mouth corners and everything. And I suddenly had some sort of backbone, you know, tragedy as a backbone for a comedy. And I think that was missing before that. It was just, you know, a high concept comedy idea, but there was no real drama or tragedy for the characters. And that was the initial moment for, you know, for this story that we've made into a film now. And I think that from that, it went quite fast. I think I started writing the script in January 2020, and we started shooting in late summer.
And I'm guessing, you know, do you think that, like, when you had the idea, you know, pre-Goldfish, were you... This tends to happen a lot with albums, with artists and their albums and filmmakers and their films. Did you have sophomore film jitters? Like, were you a bit nervous about how it would perform against this fantastic, successful debut film?
Well...
As you were making it, were you worried?
It's funny.
I mean,
because
everyone's nervous about it.
Because it's funny because, yeah, there is this term for that, some, I think, from the music industry, this, that this, like, the second album is always the shittiest or something like that, right?
There's a couple of expressions. My favorite one, and this works for films too, is that, but I'll say it for albums, you have your whole life to make your first album. You have 8 months to make your second.
Yeah.
That's the expression, you know, because like the label timeline. But it's also the same with film. Usually you have your whole life to make that first great film. And then did you feel any pressure from people to get JGA going and rolling?
Yeah, well, that's funny because I've been warned about this even during shooting the first one, because the, you know, everything went great and everyone was so happy, the cast and Tom, I think Tom Schilling, the main character of Goldfish, warned me about this and he said, look, this was a great experience and everything, and we'll, you know, everyone loves you now, but, you know, just to let you know, your second film is not going to be like that. And I said, well, we'll see about that.
Old words. Like,
no, it was, he said it as a friend.
Tom Schilling.
It was like, very, you know, as a friend, he told me, don't get too excited. Like,
yeah,
it's not going to be this the whole time because, you know, it was very euphoric in a way.
Sure.
The first experience. But it didn't feel that way at all. The second feature, I think, is more my debut than was my first, because the first, the Goldfish Mar, was, it started as an assignment. It was not my first album that I was working on my whole life. You know, it was just something that I got lucky. They said, okay, do you want to do this? And I said, well, I don't know if I can, you know, because, you know, comedy, I don't know, this kind of comedy is usually, I've never tried it before. So let's give it a chance. I saw it as an opportunity to, like a film school thing, you know, just the extension of the film school. I said, okay, I mean, what a better chance to go for it, for some, you know, big mainstream comedy here, and to try it out. And then, you know, with that, for the second film, there was, of course, not just the script, but then, okay, this guy who has already made, you know, a successful comedy in Germany. So I had more freedom and there were more trust in, okay, if you say the scene with the stripper is going to work, then just go ahead like that. Okay. So there was more, I think, more of a, in terms of style, a more personal film, the second one. So actually the pressure that you're talking about, I think I feel it more with the third one, because now I'm doing my,
that makes sense,
my second film in my own style. So it's the third film. So I'm more nervous about the third one, especially because Jotka didn't do so well at the box office because of, you know, the pandemic, the war, and the good weather, and maybe,
of course,
other reasons that, whatever. But, you know, we didn't have a very, you know, very good start with that compared to the Goldfish, you know. And, you know, cinema or, you know,
sure,
is
sure,
struggling
sure
at the moment in general, and we, you know,
definitely
we, I think we're part of a whole new situation with how people, you know, what people want to really see in theaters and are willing to go out and pay like 10 euros for a ticket.
I think releasing any film in the cinema right now is still kind of a risk, even for bigger films. I mean, with Jotka, that is a risk, because, you know, I think with the Goldfish especially, you have Tom Schilling, who can kind of pull more strangers in to say, oh, well, I like him, let's see what this new film is. But with Jotka, the three lead actresses, they aren't super well known, right? Or am I wrong?
No, I mean Luisa Haya is she won a Lola, which is like the German Academy Award or something like that for a performance 2 or 3 years ago. She's well known for dramas, and she but I think Yeah, I can't say how popular she is. It's always hard to measure, you know.
It's hard to say.
But yeah. She's not a newcomer or anything. So she's quite well known. But she's not not a brand for comedy like. And also, I think Tom Schilling also was not a brand for comedy. But I think what I like about this type kind of casting is because in Germany people are very cautious when they hear it's a German comedy. They go like, well, okay, that's probably not for me then, right? So I guess I personally am one of those guys. You know, if I weren't in the industry myself, I probably wouldn't watch German comedies, to be honest. And so with casting,
and why is that?
Well, because Germany had great comedians, but it's a long time ago. Like I really like Loriot. I don't know if you're familiar with that, or the great Bavarian comedian Gerhard Polt. But it's a couple of decades ago. So since then, nothing really interesting happened, and they've done a few really horrible comedies. So the cliche of Germans not having a sense of humor is kind of there with I can show you some German comedies that would make you cry in a way. They're so bad. So that's and
I can imagine it.
The sad part is that some of them were quite successful. So they had like sometimes 4 or 5 or 6 million viewers in Germany, and so they have their audiences with those really stupid comedies. So that's why a lot of people, also Germans, of course, they say, but that's not my kind of. So even in Germany, there is this, caution, or what is hesitation when there's the brand German comedy on it. You have to really convince people who are afraid, to get, to see a really stupid film that it's going to be different. Trust me, this one. And and that's why we...
Right, I was going to ask, do you feel like with your films that you're pushing against the odds in a sense? Like, I was very, very, very blown away with The Goldfish, because like you said, I had my own expectations. I hadn't really found anything in the German comedy realm that I thought, this is good. This is a bit like more my style. I always see the posters for like Liebeke's Junkie and stuff, and I think like, I'm never going to watch that stuff. So then when there's like, to be fair though, you were recommended through a friend whose taste I trust, like, oh, you got to get Ali on there, And I thought, okay, well, if he says it's good, it's probably really good. And then seeing it, I was still very blown away how much I liked it. So I feel like maybe you are kind of like pushing against the majority to get your type of comedy seen here in Germany by Germans. Do you feel that way?
Well, I mean, not willingly. It's for me, and it's not about to, I'm making comedies. I'm not a revolutionary or anything like that. But I'm just making. My humor. I'm making comedies that that I would watch. That I would like. And I think I grew up with like many people with American comedies, because they're pretty good at it. And there is this tradition of Jewish American.
Thank you.
Jewish American writing writer directors like Ernst Lubitsch and Wilder and the Coens, or even Judd Apatow and people like that. So there is this tradition of character centric comedies that I really like, and I don't see that much of these comedies around here, because it's separate. There's some sort of weird separation. Either it's like a high concept stupid premise comedy thing that or it's a very subtle, humorous thing that, either way, there is no mix of having real characters going really wild in comedy set pieces, which I like, and which I think where American cinema industry is great in, to have that kind of combination, to have really interesting characters put in really, really ridiculous situations, And all in Germany is always like they're... Even when you're developing a story or writing a script, people are like, but that's but that's like slapstick, isn't it? And I say, yeah, what's the problem with slapstick? You know, so
there's, what's wrong with that?
What's wrong with, you know? And everyone's like, you know, when it's aged, when, you know, people, the same guys look back at Charlie Chaplin and say, wow, he's a master. He was the greatest. And just because, you know, the you know, during the, it's a lot, you know, to, you know, everyone can agree on the, you know, comedies that have proven through time that they're masterpieces. But when it's like a current or very, what is, how to say, very, yeah, like just a comedy that's
like
just
a,
really
like a modernized,
yeah,
version.
Yeah, if it's just, you know, from this time, people are very, especially with mm-hmm. comedy, it usually gets no praise because people are not, I don't know, especially in Germany, there is this thing, if it's funny, it's probably not art thing, you know, and.
Wow.
It's a very interesting perspective because I think, sadly, there's a lot of truth about that.
Yeah, it is.
If it's funny, it's probably not art. Oh my God. That's amazing. And if I'm gonna get a tattoo,
and
of
if
that.
It's black and white, I mean, look at the German Academy that they I think during the past 10 or 11 years, four of the winners for the best picture were shot in black and white, and there weren't that many nominees shot in black and white. So there's this. On the other hand, there's this you know, cliche of what's probably art. So if it's funny, it's not. But if it's black and white, it probably is. And that's a German Leitkultur. Right?
Doesn't that make it easier for you as a director to have these kind of goals that you can meet or not?
Yeah, man. It seems to be pretty easy to
get an award. Like, okay, I know I just need to do a black and white movie that's not too funny, and we should be fine.
Right.
Yeah, there are buttons that you can push, and I really believe it. And I you know, when I started off making films at the film school, and I was like, okay, like the greatest thing that can happen to you is when, you know, if your film is selected by a festival. And then because the industry, you know, they're all thinking about money and they're, you know, commercial and everything and things like that. And by the time I learned that, you know, festivals have, it's their own industry, you know, it's an industry in itself. And they have like, it's not like they watch all movies and they say, wow, let's just go by quality, you know, in Cannes. Like half of the slots are already pre-booked, you know, even before the films are made. They know that guy, you know, Mike Lee is having a film next year. They don't care what it is. They're going to show it. It's going to be in competition and something like that. So, and, you know, when it comes to film length, I think even the industry is more permissive than is the festivals, because like they have these rules that if your film is 30 minutes and 5 seconds, it can't compete in this short film section because it's only up to 30 seconds. Whereas, you know, with my producers now, if the film is just about a little, you know, like we agreed on like 100 minutes, it's now 120 something, they'll say, okay, you know, they don't care. So my feeling is that the film industry,
that's amazing.
The festival industry is not. You know, that's something I learned. So I don't go after awards or festivals anymore. I'm just looking, you know, if is the film working for an audience? You know, if the people who paid, you know, $10 to see the movie, are they enjoying it? That's what it's about, I think. And not really about commercial success and not about, you know, awards or anything. Just about the people who, you know, spending 2 hours of their time to you know, watch something that you've created, you know, and that's all about it.
That part, that specific mentality about the people you're creating your, you know, it's funny and it is art. The people you're creating your art for, that is actually a very, very similar mentality to music. You know, like as an independent musician, when I perform at a show, I'm trying to make sure that the however many people it is, if it's 10 or if it's 300, if it's whoever has spent the money at the door to come see a good show and have fun, and they had to work for this money, they had to get a babysitter, some of them, they had to, you know, call in favors or try, you know, they had to spend money on dinner. Maybe they got a nice new outfit to wear out. Like people who spend their money on entertainment.
Yeah.
Especially as an independent musician, when you're there, your goal is to give them the best, most fun,
true,
most interesting thing that they maybe haven't seen.
Yeah.
In a while, or something that they really exactly what they wanted to see. So I can imagine that mentality is very similar with making a film. You want the people who are paying the ticket stub to go in and forget about their problems for 2 hours.
Yeah, I mean, at least not to bore them to death. You know, just being like, I'm the great artist, and
at least,
that's the minimum. Like just make it whatever you're doing, just make it in some way entertaining. You don't have to be, yeah, it doesn't have to be funny to be entertaining, but it has to be, you know, some, you know, you have to give them something, you know. And there's, right, especially during my time in the film school, there was this other mentality, like you know, as an artist you're allowed to challenge your audience. It was like, you know, you're allowed to bore them to death if that's what you intend to, if that's whatever. And I think that the time, you know, and I think it was okay like in the 70s or 80s, but I think times have changed because there's so, right, many opportunities around, so many, you were, you know, overwhelmed by media. And I think it's really hard to get the attention in the first place. And if you do, you have to hold on to it, you know, with just being entertainment. And I think it's a challenge today.
Is it something that bothers you?
Sorry?
Is it something that bothers you at times?
No, not at all. I mean, I try to, you know, when you meet with friends, you know, you do the same thing. You know, you invite someone for dinner. You know, what you do is, you don't sing or dance with them, but you try to be entertaining or at least not boring. You know, that's what you do.
You don't. Some people might.
Some people who can sing, they, you know, but I'm speaking for myself, of course. I would sing if I could, but you know, people, you know, that's the minimum. I think it doesn't have to be much. Just out of respect for other people. I think it's just, mm-hmm, a sign of respect to say, you know, I'm trying to entertain you in a way. And I really mean, because entertainment has this label of, you know, it's just pure entertainment and not art and, you know, just stupid shit. But I don't mean it in this way, like it has to be colorful and, you know,
right,
whatever. But it has to, you know, be some sign of I'm interested if as a storyteller or a musician or whatever, if you're bored at this moment or not. You know, are you with me or are, right, you not with me? And I think that's what you mentioned in the beginning with, you know, performing for digital audience or through Zoom or whatever. I think that could be very frustrating because you don't get that feedback. You know, are the people with you,
right,
or not? Without that feedback, you're lost. And that's also, you know, that the difficult part in filmmaking, because you know you make your film and then you send it out and you don't really,
and you hope,
and you, like, hope to be, yeah, you know, of course you do some screen tests and everything with live audiences and to see if it works just a couple of times, and you hope that, you know.
All right, are you when your films come out, do you find yourself on some dark evening sitting in your chair with a whiskey glass and like looking at Google reviews or IMDb or Rotten Tomatoes or things like that? Do you find yourself looking at, you know, perusing comments online?
Well, no comments. I mean, I have a extension for Safari that hides comments, which is something that I did.
That's amazing.
Because I think,
wow,
you know, there's this saying, I think Albert Einstein said something, he's not sure if the universe is infinite, but he's sure that the stupidity of humankind is infinite. And I have to think about it when I see the comment section. It's like, it makes me sad all the time. Not, you know, it doesn't matter which topic, you know, it's just people have, right, these devices in their hands, you know, and they just don't think about it anymore. You know, you know, back in the days, yeah, when you wanted to make a public statement, you know, you had to get out of the house, you know. And during the time, you know, when you put your pants on and the shirt on, you had some time to think about what you're going to say. You know, it took you at least like
right,
half an hour to get to Hyde Park or whatever you want to shout out your stupid opinion to think about it. But now it's just, you know, just send it. And it's just
word vomit now.
Dude, it's so much in my job right now. From time to time, I'm super happy that it's only like half a day every few weeks. But I have to do for the social media accounts of Bayerischer Rundfunk for their sports section. Like from time to time, I have to do a little bit of community management. And that's something I could not deal with on a daily basis because it's so much. And like you said, no matter the topic,
it
has this dynamic that within a few hours, if the topic is kind of spicy enough to trigger any kind of discussion, like within 20 minutes, you're from, hey, what you're saying is not right to... like the worst
really racist things. And so it's all about sexism. Absolutely. And racism, like after 20 minutes it's really disgusting. It's
crazy.
It really is, and I've never seen that more prevalent in more abundance, I'll say, than when I started doing these like TikTok videos about living in Germany and like kind of talking about German culture and, you know, showcasing parts of the language that I find interesting and kind of making like funny videos. I never saw that more, that mentality of the commenter, than when this started taking off, because sometimes I'll do a thing where I'm not necessarily being mean. I'm just making a joke about something that maybe bores me about Germany or something that I find silly or different, and like maybe 80% of the time, which I don't even think people need to comment on these things, I could just block it, I guess, but some people say, you know, nice things or like I like these videos or just, you know, general positivity thing, and the other 20 or 30% depending on the video is just so taking it so seriously. And it's not meant to be taken seriously at all. It's so crazy that they blow up and get so passionate about. I said something about like, oh yeah, you know, I like living in Bavaria, but it's a little less like spontaneous and exciting as where I come from. But you know, that's not Bavaria's fault. I'm from New Orleans and it has a great culture and it's very exciting. And someone was like, I travel to the US all the time. What culture in New Orleans are you even talking about? And part of me was like, okay, I'm going to send this guy a link that...
Just ignore it.
Ignore it.
I mean, yeah, it's like... If you're walking down the street and some guy is shouting, you know, Jesus gonna save you or whatever, and, you know, you don't talk back like, no, I don't think so, or anything like that. You know, you just ignore right. that guy. He's shouting whatever, you know, some stupid shit or whatever. And, you know, it's a funny thing in the comment section. I find myself having the same urge, like, I have to. And sometimes I post something and delete it a second later, just think, what am I doing here?
Sure.
So it's really, I think it's one thing that the world could live without is the comment sections. And I think they have, even in, you know, like proper, you know, like Die Zeit or Süddeutsche, even there in the comment sections, it's just horrible, you know, what people write there. It's just, I don't know why they have them in the first place. So. But to come back to your question, I do read the reviews, like whatever journalists, you know, people who are trained to write or take the time to watch the movie actually before they write something, and you know, have try to find some arguments even if they don't like it. And fortunately, with Jotka, we got even better reviews than with the Goldfish. I have here, they send me a book.
Really, that's awesome.
The distributor say. It's called Pressespiegel. So it's all the reviews that we got for JGA, and
that's insane. Yeah,
it's very satisfying to have that.
For those who can't see, he just showed me like an enormous Harry Potter book full of reviews, like this novel of reviews,
and they're all written by J.K. Rowling.
Yeah, the press really liked it, and but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's gonna be a box office hit, as we learned now. So, tear your movie apart, and it's gonna be a box office success, and vice versa. So in this case, we got lucky with the reviews, which yeah, which gives me some, of course, definitely some sort of satisfaction. But yeah, we didn't have the luck at the box office this time.
Talking about your role in the industry, because what I thought about, we mentioned earlier, you both write and direct the films you have made so far. Like, what did you have to do as a, I don't know how to say, a rookie director and screenwriter coming out of university? Like you mentioned, the Goldfish developed throughout your last year or so of university. What did you have to do to make all these people, the people with the money in the industry, give you that trust to direct the screenplays you write as a newcomer?
Well, with the Goldfish, I think it was very different. Some, you know, quite a few steps to get there. And one was, you know, in the first place, always luck. I mean, to meet the right person that really likes your writing and, you know, trusts in you. Because in the beginning, you know, you don't have a perfect screenplay. You don't have some bits and pieces that are working great, but you need someone, you know, along the way and by your side to you know, have the trust and, you know, also pays you enough to, you know, so you can pay your rent and continue writing. And that was the, you know, to get there with a good screenplay that everyone liked. And it was really amazing to see with the Goldfish that screenplay was like a door opener for it, for everything. You know, the financing was just, you know, took a couple of days, like it felt like that. And the casting, you know, we had everyone we asked to come to casting came, and it was amazing to see how a, you know, apparently a well-written script can do for a rookie like myself. When it came to directing, it was a different thing because I'd done some, you know, 45 minutes as was my like longest film that I've done, that I had done in the university. But they said, well, like the tonality is kind of different. It wasn't like full-on comedy what you did so far. So we came out, with the idea, Justina, my producer, and I, because she really wanted me to direct this. She was, I think, also afraid of someone else coming along and really fuck it up or something in a way. So she really, really wanted me to direct this. And we made a short film with, like, I think, 2,000 euros, where I played myself and she even played herself. And we made fun of our situation that I am trying to convince other producers to trust me to direct this movie. So that was the short film was about, this convincing others that I'm funny enough to direct this movie. And of course,
can we see that?
I was trying to get to a meeting to convince him and everything went wrong. So I wasn't, in my character was not funny at all, but the things that happened to me were quite funny. And also there were two scenes that were quite similar to two scenes in the actual script. So it was my way to show that's how I would approach the, you know, directing and blocking or whatever and it was quite successful. So they laughed a lot. I think it was like a 10 or 15 minutes thing, or even shorter, I don't know. And they really liked it. And they said, okay, this guy can also direct funny.
That's interesting. You
know, it's because it's not necessarily
that's
the same
interesting
thing.
Yeah. But great idea of yours as well to promote yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. I had a few just a few more questions about the process of Yotkea before we end it, or before we move on too much. So one question I wanted to ask about was, what was the casting process like for you? Because obviously, you shared a very, very funny actor from The Goldfish who also played one of the friends of Tim in this film. Is that correct? The one who had the allergy?
Yeah, Axel Stein. Yeah,
and then. Right, he was fantastic, and then of course the three leading ladies. You know, are they inspired from real women in your life? How did you land upon them and say this is my Yasmin, this is my Gina, this is my Anna, this is for sure.
Well, I mean, the dynamic of the trio here is, I mean, it's a common thing in comedies to have, that's, you know, the trio is, I think, is older than cinema itself. You have that
the Holy Trinity.
Yeah, you have your main character, and you have a, you know, sidekick that's quite the opposite, and And you know, it's always, I think the an influence was the trio in the Big Lebowski. That was always the dynamic I was thinking about when I was thinking about these three girls, and I wanted to do a female version of that, the Big Lebowski trio here. And I think Gina is more like the John Goodman character.
That's amazing.
And, really loud and some, you know, very acting upon, you know, values and rules and something like
that. She's a loose cannon.
Yeah. And Yasmin is kind of tries to just get things done, doesn't care how or whatever. And you have that pale comic relief character, the you know, this fifth
sort of the dummy,
and which is Anna, which is that was the sort of dynamic I was looking for. And I knew that it's not about, you know, casting the right characters, but casting the right trio. So we had a lot of great actresses for each role, but it was more about how they, you know, come together. And
like the chemistry
was very important in this case, and because it's about friendship at the end. This is really the subject here is friendships, and it's about these three friends here. And I remember the first time these three actresses came in the same room for casting. They didn't even, you know, they hadn't even done a scene yet, but I knew this is gonna be the main cast of the film, because suddenly something,
you saw them walk in and instantly
something changed in the room as they, you know, they came in, and it was a different feeling. It was not like, okay, three actresses standing around, but you know, you had the feeling there was some sort of connection here, and I think even this, some sort of friendship formed through their work on this film, and you really can feel it, because they weren't there, you know. We shot during the pandemic, so they had to stay in Munich even over the weekends, and they spent really every minute together, even if they in their free time. And it was really great to see how the chemistry is doing so much, not only for the film, but also for the working environment and on the set. It was we got just lucky in this case, but we had I was stressed because we had a lot of great actresses for each role, but it's not about, you know.
Yeah, that must have been very difficult
finding the
to
best actress,
narrow it down. But
finding the best chemistry in this case, yeah.
But does that happen more often, or how likely is that to happen? Because I know it from playing music with other people in bands, etc.
Yeah.
But how likely is it to happen that like people build real personal connections, relationships on a film set?
Well, you don't know, but I think it's you never know. I mean, we were lucky because they could also said, you know, they could have read the script and say, no, I don't want to come to the casting or anything like that. So you don't know. But I think that's one part is luck. The other part is being open to vibes like that, you know, is what I mean? So to look for it. And I always look, I'm not looking that much for, is this a good actor or actress, or how did he, you know, act out that line or whatever? But I'm looking for, is there chemistry also between me and the actor or actress? So if there's some sort of connection between, you know, if I like someone and I like some other guy or whatever, there is the probability that they're gonna like each other in a way is high, I think. So always in the first place go for, do I like that person really as a person? And I always cast people who I really also like. So I wouldn't go, so if someone came along who was just, you know, tremendous, do a tremendous scene in the casting, but it was, you know, some kind of asshole, I could never you know, cast that person in the film.
Right.
I couldn't work with some. I can't work. No. I can't imagine working with someone I can't respect. And I think
absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So that I think is there. So through that is the probability is higher that you find people that actually they find a chemistry, you know, on set.
Because I find that interesting, making a movie that is about friendship in the end. Yeah. If that depends a little bit on, is the director and the people making this film, are they able to create these kind, or at least a sense of these kind of relationships that should be visible for the viewers at the end.
Well, I mean, but at the end, you never know. I mean, I've heard stories about, I think, Notting Hill, I think, with Hugh Grant and Julia Roberts. Oh, yeah. I think I've heard stories that they really hated each other and that Julia Roberts were like very difficult on set during filming. But that's something, you know, you don't really see. So you see, you watch the film and you go like, oh my God, they really love each other. And there's this kind of, you know, it's always possible. I don't think it's necessarily, you know, it's just my approach. And I think I personally find it difficult to create the, you know, that kind of a big lie if I see that they really hate each other, and then go action, and then, you know, if they're professional enough, you can make it, and you know the audiences can't tell. And I think that a lot of people can't tell if, you know, there were good chemistry on set or not, because I think there could be cases of people really having a great time on set, but you know, it's not on the screen, you know, and people don't really see it or feel it. So it's two things. So I personally feel that it helps having that chemistry in the first place, and from that create through tools and through style and whatever the friendship that's on the screen, because you can't just rely just on the fact that, you know, the actresses like each other. You know, that's not gonna be enough for the film.
And in general, like from the beginning of that process, finding the golden trio. And then, of course, finding some of the smaller roles, like Tim's friend group, and then, you know, the smaller roles from there. How long was that process? And was it as long as the Goldfish casting, or shorter?
It was shorter because our whole, plan was a bit shorter. So, you know, because I had, a really great casting director, Daniela Tolkien, who came up with great ideas for each role, actually. And I was really, really pleased, especially with the minor characters and, you know, smaller parts in the film, because they ran, you know, they're underestimated. You know, it's like someone, a character comes in a scene and has just one or two lines, they really can fuck up the whole movie. You know, you can do, people have the focus on the main characters, and they do, you know, they spend a lot of time in casting those main characters, and they say, okay, that guy just is like two lines. And I'm like, no, you know, just get it, you know, do a proper casting, because whatever your main character is doing, you know, she can't be great, but if there's some disbelief in that other guy with just his two lines, you know, the whole scene crumbles, you know, it goes like there's nothing left then afterwards. So it's really important, and I really sometimes in love with my you know, actors who come just for a day to play a part, and I'm so thankful when they do a great job. And I think we had a couple of those in JKA. Especially at the end with the wedding, there's this guy who sits next to Yasmin who really gets on her nerves and so on. He did a great job. Or even Jakob Gessner, who played...
He was perfectly casted.
So I was really happy with him.
And he was so believable. That type of guy is very, very believable and very real. without spoiling too much about it. And did you work with the same DP as the first film?
Yes, Matthias Fleischer, and also the same art director, Josef Brandl.
And the same art director. Yeah. I remember in our first conversation about the Goldfish a few years back, I had it in my notes about how colorful and quite saturated it is. And I thought you might have worked with the same people. Again, I didn't think to look at the credits after, but... It felt the same way. Like there's some shots where they're on the beach and they have their bright coats and the dresses. And I thought this is so I don't know what the right word, like, I don't want to say like, it's just colorful, but it's just like, it's very vibrant.
Yeah.
And I thought he must have worked with the same guy, because that's like, if you're looking for your visual flavor, because your writing flavor is your humor. But if you're looking for your visual mark or watermark, I think it might be the way that these two films look, because they do have this distinct color palette to them, it seems like.
Well, that's something that we really work hard on with the costume department, the art department, and with the, you know, camera department. It's really, you know, tight collaboration to, and you know, since we're not after, you know, going for awards, we really like working with colors, I guess. So we really go there and think, okay, so how can we be, as you say, vibrant and colorful, but just not, you know, put every, you know, it doesn't matter what.
But not like, yeah. And I want to be clear, it's not like unnecessarily or that it takes me out of the story. It's just that's just something I notice. I just thought, oh, that must have been the same guy. It looks great, you know?
Now we do a lot of tests before we start shooting with colors and tones and with costumes and how to, you know, to find the right balance that it doesn't feel like, okay, they painted all the walls here just to have that green in the picture, but it's it feels, you know, we hope it feels it has some sort of identity without
it does
without, you know, having the feeling that it was imposed on characters or anything. So it really also work from the character's point of view. Would they wear that kind of jacket or this color and that? And I think in this case, the jackets were like the starting point and said, okay, let's go for that metallic like drive kind of a look just for you know, other context here. But from there, we you know, continued and developed our color palette for this film.
That's something
Go ahead.
That's something I have so much respect for, like the looks and the colors of basically any footage that's being put out. From the perspective as me as a video journalist, I also shoot and edit own footage for journalistic pieces I do for TV or YouTube or whatever. And then I learned some basics about color grading, and then you're editing your piece and you're getting to color grading and start to play around. And it's so easy if you want a strong, vibrant, colorful look to ruin everything.
Yeah.
There's such a fine line of just throwing in too much of everything. And that's not even being in a situation where you think about how does the set look where I shoot, because you're just shooting where you have to go to do interviews or whatever. But just by color grading, you can ruin everything so fast. And I have so much respect for thoughtful, fine craft being shown there. And that's what I see in your movies. Yeah.
No, thank you. I mean, it's harder if there is, it's, you know, because you can take out color. Taking out color is always easier. And if you're going for a colorful look or a vibrant look, you have to be really careful what's in the picture, because you can't do much about it. In post-production, so you have to have your vision really beforehand and be on the set to say, okay, this, you know, and if this film has its identity, you know, even, you know, if you've seen someone serves a cocktail with the wrong color, you go like, no, it should be, it has to be a different cocktail.
Yeah,
it has
yeah.
to be like whatever, swimming pool or anything, but that kind of yellow doesn't fit, you know, so it's really about also, you know, what, you know, the small things, because they're going to be big on the screen, you know, and they matter at the end.
I would have one more question, and then before we let you go, I would tell you just two or three of my favorite things about the movie. But my last question that I have written down, at least. So I know your composer, Carlos Sipa.
Yes.
And he's a very, very extraordinarily talented pianist. He writes great original music. He works on film. I think this is the second time he's worked with you. Is that right? But probably before that as well. And I know a lot of people that he's worked for and with, and I've met him several times. Very nice guy. I have a question about the music on this film, because something that really stuck out to me, and I want to know what your reasoning was behind this. Maybe he pitched it and you said, that's great. And I wanted to know why. So what happens throughout the film quite a lot, and even until the very end, is that he takes basically like the famous classical music piece for Elise, and he readjusts it into a new modern arrangement. Which is such a really unique thing to do, because you have this very famous piece, so you think it's going, and da na 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 na, you think it's going there, and then he makes it into something else that's, you know, maybe more a different key, or it's emotional, it matches this scene or that scene, and then in the credits, in the very end, obviously it's the original piece that's playing, And so my question was, what was the, you know, his, you know, feelings behind that choice? You know, did he pitch that to you? Did you have a conversation about, okay, why are we taking this song and morphing it around? Yeah. Or, you know, what was the conversation behind the music?
Well, it's important to point out a scene in the film for the listeners here to be able to follow our reasoning for the choice. There is a scene after the bride to be in the beginning is being picked up by her husband and leaving her own hen party, where the three girls are in a you know, small kasheme, as we say, or a small bar where, you know, like the last people, you know, the last refuge, a very small bar where they are, and they're trying to cancel their plane tickets, and they're on hold on the phone, and it's this how do you call it? Warteschleife in a waiting.
They're in this on this waiting line, yeah.
for the airline, and trying to reach someone. At the same time, the other character is daydreaming and talking about, you know, finding someone as a partner for life. So this is this where this two, you know, this simple. Waiting for someone on the phone at the airline support line correlates with finding someone in life. So was our starting point. We wanted to have that melody that's overused in waiting lines when you call a support line. And in a short moment, someone will be there for you. And there is this melody. And one very overused melody is Beethoven's Für Elise. And actually, we didn't start there. We wanted to create our own melody for the support line. And Carlos had done some really terrific job on that already. But it felt like too sophisticated what he had done. And you know, quite late in the project, he said, you know what, let's just go for Elisa in this scene. And during that scene, we start as Für Elise, but somehow as we get lost with the characters in the horror scenario, what could happen if they never find someone in their lives? Yeah, like the melody or the notes kind of start to elevate and, you know, lose their lines, and it becomes more transcendent, something like that, and it goes back again to being Für Elise. Just for a moment, we leave that. You know, classic overheard and overused. And we said, okay, from then.
Yeah, it like breathes out.
Yeah. Sorry. For a moment. But it is Für Elise. It is introduced as Für Elise in the support hotline for the airline.
Right.
And from there, Carlos developed the melody. You know, it doesn't repeat that much. I think they're just three other cues in the whole movie where you hear a variation of Für Elise,
right?
And
yeah, towards the end.
Yeah, and we thought it would be great as a result to listen to Für Elise in the credits, but it feels that you're listening to it for the first time. Because if you listen to music that's overused and you don't really hear the music anymore, and that's what we all feel with Für Elise, because it's like da 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 da, and you know, you think of piano lessons or whatever, or being stuck in an elevator, but you don't really listen to the music. But I think Carlos really managed to have that feeling through the variations of Für Elise throughout the film, that when at the end of the credits, the original piece is played by Carlos himself, you really feel the music. And that's at least how I felt. I was like, oh my God, this is a beautiful piece, you know, of piano music that was
destroyed
by piano students. you know, with it.
That's a really creative choice. I tried to figure it out, but in the end I just had to ask, but it really does make sense. It really fits, and it's a cool idea. And he's a beautiful man. He plays beautifully. He's very talented. He's a very talented guy.
Actually, I met him first for Moritz Binder's film. He composed his short film called Thumb.
He did. Was it?
And it was
Thumb.
Yeah,
right. Yeah, Thumb's great.
He wrote some pieces for that, and it was extraordinary. It was I've never heard such a complex score for a film for university short film. It was just, and I said, okay, this guy's right. Really going somewhere, and I also like working with him because
absolutely
he is this classical deep piano guy, but he's very humorous, so I'm glad he's willing to work with me on like stupid comedies like this. but he has a good sense of humor, which is important for working in something like that that has both the comedy and also the serious tones.
For those who want to check out his music, you should go to Spotify and type in Carlos, Carlos, and then Sipa, Cipa. He has some beautiful original pieces up there you should check out. Okay, so here at the end, because I know we've had you for a long time, I appreciate you spending so much time with us today. I wanted to tell you a few of my favorite things about it. First off, my favorite line from the movie: some miss out on their whole lives because they're afraid of missing out.
Mm-hmm.
That is a great line. I don't know how it was said in German, but the translation is so beautiful. And some miss out on their whole lives because they're afraid of missing out. I really like that, and that really stuck with me. Was that one of those lines that you wrote and thought, "Ooh, that's the golden ticket"?
Well, I'm always a bit
something that.
Yeah, thank you for that. No, I think it's even a bit better in English in this case because it rhymes a bit. In German, it's what's in German? It's aus Angst was zu verpassen manche ihr ganzes Leben is the German phrasing, which also works good. But I'm always, when I write something like that, which is could be like on a calendar thing, like a quote on a calendar.
Right, like a life lesson.
Yeah, like a life lesson. I'm like, nah, delete it. And I'm like, nah, this is something maybe too preachy or anything like that. But it was just right for that moment and that scene. So I left it in. So I think, that's, usually people don't talk like prophets or I like characters who struggle for to find the right words, like I do all the time, because that's more relatable. I'm always really, when I see characters who are too fluent or come up with great lines every 2 seconds, I'm like, okay, I can't really relate to that character. But that's just one moment for the main character where she has some, it's an empowering moment for her too, because she's suffered enough throughout the movie and now she has.
Totally, yeah. And another one was, I believe it's the same character earlier in the film, talks about how much she hates raclette nights, and if she gets invited to one more raclette evening, she's going to kill herself or something like that. And I paused it and was like, I know! That's exactly how I feel about every raclette night. I hate raclette. I don't get the trend. Everyone invites us to do raclette, and I always want to say no. And we had a big laugh about that. Like, wow, that's real. That's like, that was totally me. I hate raclette nights. And then, so it was two last things. One, I think the wedding was just a great climax. I don't want to spoil what happens or who does what there, but it escalated in a great way, and I think it ends in a big way, and it was a really exciting sequence for the climax. And then my favorite moment, also without spoiling anything, was after that, as the very, very end before she runs into this Philip guy, when Gina and Jasmine just put their heads against each other, as a way of like forgiving and showing love again. And it's so trusting of each other. And it's so warm and innocent and loving. And it was a really extremely well executed moment. And I I have to. I mean,
no, thank you.
I can't do what you do. I'm just saying, like, that's a great moment.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I mean, we really worked hard on that moment because, you know, it's a moment where it's quite visual because when they put their heads together, they don't say anything. So it's really about also camera angle and, you know, shapes and composition and the lighting and everything. I think
the shadow
and also the music and everything comes together at this moment, and also the acting of the two protagonists here. It's I really like that shot too, but we knew I told Matthias, my DOP, that just like half an hour before shooting this scene, I said this has to be the most beautiful shot in the whole movie, and it was like, oh, okay. Is that like also the assistant director came, so we're about to start in 20 minutes, he said, no, give me 40 minutes then. So I need to adjust the lighting a bit more, and he did, and it was worth it. Yeah.
That's so great. So the movie is JGA, Junggesellenabschied, and it's out of theaters now, but hopefully soon will be on a streaming platform. I had the pleasure of being able to watch it. So thank you again for that. And Ali, as always, man, we are so thankful for your time and for your insight. And I hope that we can see each other soon, even outside the show. Yeah. And just have a beer and keep talking about film and music, man. That's the dream.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure too. Thanks for having me, and I had a great time. It's really nice to talk to you guys.
I just want to say thank you, Ali, for showing us again that even in Germany, film can be both funny and art. And that's a beautiful thing.
Thank you very much. I try my best.
Oh, we have to end it with that. Oh my God. All right, guys, we'll stop recording here and then we can just talk for a second at the end. But guys, thank you so much for listening. Go check out Die Goldfische, the first, not the debut film from Ali. It was an assignment, but of course it was like the first big movie. Go check it out. And yes, thank you for listening. And we'll be back next week. Say bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Look out, baby. The Saints are coming through, and it's all over now, baby blue.
Artsy Fartsy Immigrants, ein Podcast von Jordan Prince und Moritz Batscheider, produziert für M94.5.